Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Over the last 12 years, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has played an integral role in efforts to build a secure and stable Afghanistan. It has sought to do this with programs in agriculture, governance, economics, education, energy, health, and infrastructure, providing Afghans with the tools, technical support, capacity building, and institutions that are the foundation for stability, development, and security. Promoting stability and order brings with it significant challenges, and many of which are heightened, especially during this delicate transition period, as the president announced that U.S. combat forces would leave Afghanistan by the end of this year. Weaning Afghanistan from unsustainable levels of assistance is necessary for us and essential for them. It is a pivotal time, and for those dedicated to this mission, ensuring that development progress in Afghanistan is maintained and made durable involves constant vigilance at this juncture. How has USAID sought to promote stability and order in Afghanistan? What is USAID's threefold transition strategy? And what are USAID's priorities going forward in Afghanistan and Pakistan? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Larry Sampler, Assistant to the Administrator and Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Larry, before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you can provide us with a brief overview of the history and evolving mission of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and more particularly, its Office of Afghan and Pakistan Affairs. When was it created and how has it evolved to date?
Yeah, certainly. Let me put this in the context of Dr. Shah's new mission statement. USAID has been in existence for decades, but Dr. Shah has evolved a mission statement in consultation with the interagency and within the agency as well that says that USAID partners to end extreme poverty and to support democratic societies while we pursue America's security and prosperity. The Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs emerged when President Obama came into office and wanted to focus quite specifically in some ways on those two countries. At the State Department, you may recall, he created the Office of the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. At the time, it was Richard Holbrook. And so our office is an analog to that. Within USAID, we carved from our Asia Bureau the resources that were focusing on Afghanistan and Pakistan, and we set it up first as a task force, which I describe as bureaucratically barely managed chaos. There's just lots of resources, lots of hard work, some incredibly talented people who put 14 and 16-hour days in to get this up and running. And it's evolved from a task force to what I would now humbly suggest is a fairly well-measured and well-functioning independent office at USAID. We also have an analog at the Defense Department, which is the Pakistan-Afghanistan Coordination Cell, which is run from the Joint Staff. So across the interagency, you have the three Ds. You have defense, diplomacy, and development. And you have within defense the Pakistan-Afghanistan Coordination Cell. Within state, you have the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And within USAID, you have my office. So it creates a sort of parallel structure that allows us to focus resources pretty intensively on those two countries.
Mm-hmm. So it's such an interesting mission. I'd like to get a sense of the scale of operation of your office. What's the size of your budget, the number of folks that support your mission? And can you give us a sense of what your footprint is in both countries?
The model for U.S. Agency for International Development has evolved from the days of Vietnam, when we had literally thousands and thousands of U.S. government employees out on the ground, to one now where we're more of a general contractor in some respects. We have expertise and we have areas where we will bring the expertise to the table ourselves, but we're also quite adept at partnering, whether it's for-profit firms from the United States, mm-hmm. or non-for-profits from the United States or internationally, our implementing partners, the numbers dwarf the direct hires. We probably have on the rolls of our partners in Afghanistan 5,000 to 7,000 people, all nationalities, all different skill sets, doing everything from building roads to educating women to providing health care. So, you know, you depending on how you want to define my team in Afghanistan, it's 185 U.S. government civilians, or it's thousands of implementing partners in support of the U.S. national security imperatives in Afghanistan. Pakistan is a different mission. It's much smaller, despite the fact that the country is much, much more populated. But Pakistan is a more advanced country in terms of technology and human capacity in the country itself. So we don't need quite as robust a footprint. The number of U.S. government direct hire civilians is smaller. I don't recall exactly. I want to say it's on the, around 100 to 105 U.S. government direct hire civilians. The biggest difference in the two is in Pakistan, I'm not aware of any third country nationals that we've brought in to fill a capacity that we couldn't fill from amongst the Pakistani population. You know, Pakistan has an education system. They have the human capacity to support our mission the way it needs to be supported. So we have a tremendous team of Foreign Service national staff in Pakistan, some of whom have been with the mission since it reopened in the late 1980s, early 1990s. So they've built, when you've been there for 10 or 15 or in some cases almost 20 years, they have institutional memory that they contribute to our objectives in Pakistan.
And the size of your budget?
For Afghanistan this year, for Afghanistan in 15, we've requested a budget of $1.2 billion, mm-hmm. and Pakistan will probably be on the order of $750 to $800 million.
So what about your role as the director of this office? Could you tell us a little bit more about the duties and responsibilities? And more interestingly, how do you support the overall mission of USAID?
My undergraduate degree was in physics, and so I view my role as sort of the confluence of several streams of interest. Mm-hmm. First and foremost is the safety and security of our staff in the field, and so we support the missions in Afghanistan and Pakistan 24 hours a day, 7 days a week as they need it. But another stream of influence is the Washington policy community. I'm beholden to the administrator and to the president to make sure that what our office is doing is in line with what their guidance has been. Contiguous to that is the interagency community. I mentioned defense and state, but we have countless other partners, Commerce, Department of Agriculture, Treasury. There are a number of agencies that are operating in these spaces, and we need to make sure that we're good team players with them. And I am sort of the senior government official for the interagency coordination before you get to the serious political players, the administrator and deputy secretaries and the like. And then the third, and by no means the least important, is being good stewards of the taxpayer dollars. Whether it has to do with simple cost-effective measures in Washington, how do you get the most bang for the buck from contractors that we use in Washington, to things like how do you make sure that fraud, waste, and abuse are not eating into the effectiveness of our programs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So those are the things that keep me awake in terms of my responsibilities. In terms of outreach, we have what I call a community of interest. It's certainly the Hill. And I separate that into the members of Congress themselves and their staff. The approach to the two is sometimes quite different. But then also the think tank community, the intellectual elites of Washington and the United States, who shape so much of the thinking that goes into what gets done. And then our partners. You know, our implementing partners are all either NGOs or for-profits here in the United States for the most part, and they have relationships both with the think tanks and with members of Congress. And so we address all those communities of interest to the degree that we can, and I'm, for the most part, the senior interlocutor with those communities on Afghanistan and Pakistan.
So given that role and the mission, it's a very interesting and yet complex mission. What are your top management challenges that you face, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
One of the issues would just be institutional memory. In a place like Afghanistan, it is what we call an unaccompanied tour, and it's a critical priority country, which means that the stress levels are understandably somewhat high. We've had in the past month several attacks in Kabul, Afghanistan, and I would argue and expect that most of my staff knew, at least tangentially, someone who was killed, an international who was killed in one of these attacks. The quality of life at the embassy is as good as it can possibly be, and constantly we're working with the embassy and with State Department to improve it, but it's not great. spouses are not allowed to come for the most part. So one of my challenges is making sure that for all kinds of reasons with respect to oversight and accountability, we have institutional memory about the programs that we're running in Afghanistan. Pakistan, again, it's less of a problem because we have the FSN staff who stay in place even when the Foreign Service officers rotate out. But in Afghanistan, we suffer a problem with institutional memory. Another issue is just one of sticker shock on the part of the community of interest. I'm from a small town in Georgia, and it still sometimes boggles my mind to be talking about budgets on the range of $1.2 billion. What are we doing with that much money in Afghanistan? Now, I wouldn't be spending it if I couldn't, in my heart, say, yes, this is the right thing to do, and we are getting a return on investment. And we're still working on evolving how we communicate that to our communities of interest, to taxpayers in Stone Mountain and in Iowa. That's a really big challenge. How do you tell people who may live in communities that are themselves having problems with bridges and roads that, well, we're going to spend this money to build bridges and roads in Afghanistan? And that's kind of my third big challenge, is constantly being mindful of the fact that USAID is in Afghanistan to the tune of billions of dollars because it's a national security interest for the United States. So how USAID contributes to this national security initiative and making sure that our programs align with the president's policy, with the administrator's policy, and with the interagency efforts to make sure that we are never again threatened from Afghanistan is a big part of my challenge.
Given your experience, military experience, private sector experience, and now in international development, I'm interested to understand from your mind, what makes an effective leader? What are those characteristics?
It's different in different communities, and we can talk about that if you like. An effective leader in the military may have challenges being an effective leader at state or at USAID or at other places, and vice versa. But I think it's an ability to remain mindful of the strategic while executing the operational and focusing on the tactical. And what I mean by that is, well, during the Balkan Wars, the concept of the strategic corporal was born. Mm-hmm. Strategic corporal was someone who, at the very tactical level, did something, either something very good or something very bad, but it had immediate strategic consequences. It was largely an effect of the 24/7 news cycles that we see now, that a beating or a sexual attack or something that happens in the field literally changes the course of national policy in the course within a matter of days or weeks. Modern leaders have to cope with the same thing. Decisions that we make at the tactical level, an email that one of my staff sends to another staff member about a particular project today may wind up as part of a Freedom of Information Act request next month or next year or 5 years from now that becomes, instead of just a tactical email between two young staff members discussing the merits of a particular program, It becomes part of a lawsuit, or it becomes part of a congressional inquiry or an inspector general audit, and all of a sudden it has tremendous consequences. So I build my leadership in my office around the three W's. What is it, who owns it, and when is it due? And the intent there is to remind the tactical operators that there are higher order principles that we're working on, what it is, who owns it, and when it's due, but also to make sure that the constructive ambiguity of our strategic discussions don't let us off the hook of actually delivering products. I don't like to have any meeting where at the end of it I can't go back and reiterate for the team, what is it we're delivering, who owns it, and when is it due? Failure to answer any of those three questions in significant or sufficient detail means that we really just had a meeting and nothing was particularly accomplished.
How has USAID sought to promote stability and order in Afghanistan? I will ask Larry Sampler, Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.